Hello, this is Terrence McNally. As we fasten our seatbelts and plunge into the 2024 campaign, here are two conversations that might be worth a re-listen. First, from 2007, I talk with psychologist Drew Weston about the ideas and advice in his influential book, The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. Weston found that Democrats almost always present the best arguments, but lose elections to Republicans who have mastered the art of emotion and storytelling. And in the second half, my 2009 conversation with Bernie Horn about his book, Framing the Future, How Progressive Values Can Win Elections and Influence People. Horn believes that persuadable voters make choices depending on how political issues and questions are framed. Hello, I'm Terry McNally. Welcome to Free Forum. I'm happy to be back in the studio after nearly 2 weeks out on the hills and the plains of Kenya. And I have to admit, I was there as nothing more than an awestruck tourist. I spent days and nights out of reach of most of my usual information and distraction sources, and it was a once-in-a-lifetime trip. I saw animals every day, you know, wherever I turned, that had populated my children's books and fantasies and Animal Planet. But whenever I could, I did read the local newspapers, and while I was there, the Kenyan legislature passed and sent to the president a bill that would force journalists to reveal their sources. Sound familiar? And there were two major dailies in Kenya, The Nation and The Standard. One the more liberal, one the conservative, think, you know, New York Times, Wall Street Journal. And the first time that I got a look at them, The Nation had a big front page story on this bill and freedom of the press and how are we going to fight corruption when sources have to be revealed and so on. And a planned protest by Nairobi's journalists demanding the president veto this bill. Now, neither the bill nor the planned demonstration were even mentioned in that day's Standard. Okay, front page story in The Nation, not even showing up in the entire Standard. But a few days later, the next time I got a look at a newspaper, the front page had a photo of a handful of journalists leading this march with tape over their mouths, and two of the five in this front page picture were wearing Standard T-shirts. So, journalism and journalists, I salute you. Now, in that same August 16th issue of The Nation, the Kenyan's Daily Progressive, I read an op-ed about the Kenya presidential election. And a writer named Charles Onyango Obo wrote, and I'm going to quote him, "The candidates will do well to go out and buy a book entitled The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation by Drew Weston." Now, that was in an op-ed in the Kenya's Nation. I returned to find that the August 8th Guardian of London had run two long excerpts of The Political Brain. And this past Sunday, the book was a leading review in the New York Times Review of Books. Yesterday, it was the lead article in Salon.com. And today, Drew Weston, the author of The Political Brain, will be my guest. I'll briefly quote Onyango Obo. On the message from his op-ed, "Weston has studied elections over the years and found an inconvenient truth. People almost always vote for the candidate who elicits the right feelings, not the one who presents the best arguments." And with Karl Rove and Alberto Gonzalez resigning and the good ship Bush having fewer and fewer rats left to jump overboard, I believe Weston's message is all the more important. I have long referred to Rove and company as electoral savants, remarkably gifted at demonizing and defining opponents and winning elections, but seemingly uninterested and incompetent at governing. But winning elections is job number one, and are the Democrats going to be able to seize the moment in 08? Can they win? How big can they win? And if they do, will it matter? Before I bring in Drew Weston, let me speak just for a moment about another election. For the last few years, the management of this station, KPFK, is overseen by a local station board, which is made up of 18 elected subscriber listeners and 6 staff representatives. And 9 of those subscriber positions are up for a vote this fall. The current general manager submitted her resignation yesterday, and this upcoming election will have has the potential to play an important role in how this station will evolve over the next few years and beyond. And at a time when I believe that a truly progressive voice is vitally necessary in Southern California, how will KPFK fill that role as we move into the digital age of radio, which is going to change the whole face of how we deliver and how many streams we deliver and who we deliver to? How will Los Angeles and California, the nation, deal with our own upcoming elections, with the war in Iraq and the potential of a Bush attack on Iran, with so many issues that are crucial to us both locally and nationally? Immigration, healthcare, education, transportation, the environment, the looming housing and credit crisis, which I think may end up being fighting Iraq and foreign policy for issue number one by the time the election rolls around in November. As I say weekly in my introduction to the show, I believe we can do better. And if you do too, subscribe and vote. Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, and ideas of people that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, media, politics, all based on that fact that I believe we can do better and want to find out how. Drew Weston received his BA at Harvard, an MA in social and political thought at the University of Sussex in England, and his PhD in clinical psychology at the University of Michigan, where he subsequently taught for 6 years. For several years, he was chief psychologist at Cambridge Hospital and associate professor at Harvard Medical School. He's a commentator on NPR's All Things Considered and lives in Atlanta, where he teaches at Emory University. His book, as I said, is The Political Brain. Welcome, Drew Weston, to KPFK and Free Forum.
Thanks for having me on.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. Now, your PhD is in clinical psychology. You were chief psychologist at a hospital. What was your path to this current focus on politics?
You know, it's a great question. I think it's one I've never been asked in about 200 radio interviews. You know, it's funny. As a clinical psychologist, I'm a researcher. I do research in psychology and neuroscience, but I've also been a practicing clinician for 25 years. And one of the things that's been most surprising to me in some ways is how smooth the jump is from listening to patients talk. I do study personality disorders, and so there's an easy move from studying personality disorders to you know, politicians. But
right.
But aside from that, it's what you do as a clinician is you're listening for when people are talking with you. You're listening to hear what's whirring in the background. You know what thoughts and feelings are connected up in the back of their heads that are leading them to do things that they wish they could stop doing, whether it's a pattern in a relationship that they wish they could stop but they keep doing, or that they have an eating disorder and they're binging and then purging by throwing up. What you're listening for in the background is what's whirring, and you're also listening for things that they're in conflict about. And really, in many ways, the thing that has made the transition most so the easiest for me has been that you're listening for the same thing in politics, or you should be, for what is it that that's worrying in the background when people get angry about immigration, or when there are only 2 flags burned a year, but they cast their votes based on flag burning. What you want to know is what's getting triggered, and that's the piece that I think is really continuous between my life as a clinical psychologist and now as a political strategist and advisor.
I really appreciate that. Without going into Thomas Frank's book, What's Wrong with Kansas, his big question was, why do people vote against their own self-interest? And that's the same thing that a clinical psychologist is looking for, isn't it? Why do people behave against their own self-interest?
Absolutely true. And it's funny, over the last year, I found myself speaking to a lot of Democratic and progressive organizations, and particularly donors who've been giving lots of money to the Democratic Party and watching it go down the tubes. And I almost invariably would get the question from somebody, which would be, you know, so what's the matter with Kansas? How come people are voting against their self-interest? And my response was often the same, which is, well, what's the matter with you? I mean, here you are in someone who is has the wealth to contribute to Democratic campaigns, which means you're in the Republican tax bracket, and you're voting against your own self-interest. You're doing it because you have values, and that's the same reason that a lot of voters in Kansas are voting. And the role of a leader is as much as anything else to set the agenda set the emotional agenda for what values are really most central in this election year. And that's where I think Republicans have been so much more effective and Democrats have been so much less effective in the last 40 years.
Right. So values. I think that turnaround, your response is excellent. I'm Terry McNally, and I'm speaking with Drew Weston on Free Forum, KPFK 90.7, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, streaming and podcasting at kpfk.org. Okay, so we asked why you focused on politics. What drew you to that? That's still a big leap to why did you write this book?
You ask questions that make me think you must have been a psych major as an undergrad.
I went to Harvard and I majored in social relations.
That's great. And for anyone who doesn't know, social relations and psychology were connected departments.
Exactly.
At Harvard. What really made me do it, to tell you the truth, was that I was... I've always been interested in politics and have always followed it carefully. And I still remember to this day sitting in my living room watching with a group of people Michael Dukakis offer that horrible answer about what he would do if his wife were raped and murdered, which Bill Maher has summarized well as whatever. but what really got me into doing something about it and writing this book was having two little kids and looking at the world that this administration and at that point the Republican Congress, who was pretty much rubber stamping anything that he asked for, were doing to the world that we were leaving my kids, and I just couldn't stand it anymore.
Okay, let me up the ante for a second, Drew. As I mentioned in my introduction, you and your book are everywhere these days, right? I told you that op-ed in the Kenyan Daily Nation, New York Times, this place, that place, etc. You've touched a nerve. People want to know what you've got to say. Two questions. Why do you think that's so? Why do you? Everyone writes a book hoping it matters, but you have touched a nerve. And then the fact that you've not only got a book, but you got a book with buzz gives you an opportunity. What are you hoping to accomplish with this moment?
Oh, those are two great questions. Well, the first one is, you know, much as I wish I could say, well, of course it's a brilliant book, and that's why people are reading it. I'm enough of a scholar of intellectual history to know that the times are often ready. You know, it's the term for it that you'll remember from your old Harvard days is the zeitgeist. You know, that there's kind of ideas brewing in the air that are waiting for somebody to articulate and spell out systematically. And I think in some ways that's all I've really done, is to take an idea that many of us in our guts understood, which was that when Democrats talk about things, when they talk about, I mean, when I say to you the environment, do you feel anything? Probably not. If I say to you consumer affairs, do you feel anything? No. You go through the list of the words that we use on the left to describe the things that matter to us, you'd have no idea that they matter to us. And the idea that emotion is central to everything that we do in politics, that it's what arouses people's interest as well as their motivation, the idea that values actually matter and that people on the left have values just like people on the right have values, and that the difference between them is not that one has them and one doesn't, but that we have competing value systems and we ought to be enunciating exactly what those are so that people can make a choice. I think those are things that people were waiting for somebody to say in a way that they could hear. And so I suspect that if people are buzzing about the book, that's probably mostly why.
And that second question, now that you realize, golly, they're listening to me. I'm not just speaking to an Emory classroom. I've got the ear of some people with power, some people with money. You've spoken, I know, with Obama, Edwards, and Clinton people. When you're driving alone home in the afternoon in that Atlanta traffic, what is it you hope you can do with this moment?
Well, really, two things. One is just in general to get them to rethink the words that they use, so that the next time they want to talk about the environment, instead they think about how to talk about that in a way that's emotionally compelling to people, so that they'll care. I mean, you know, right now we have 20% of pregnant mothers have enough mercury in their systems to damage the brain of their unborn children. why don't we talk about that when we talk about the environment? You know, those are the kind of things. I mean, I just heard the House Minority Leader here in Georgia, who is a Democrat, because the Democrats are in the minority, say the other day in a wonderful speech, you know, I'm so tired of talking about the environment. Let's talk about the fish. I want to be able to eat the fish that my son and I catch in the streams of Georgia again. There's a way you talk about appealing to rural America. That's how you appeal to rural America. So that's the first thing I'd like people to hear. And that message, I think, is getting through.
Mm-hmm.
The one that's harder to get through because it runs against so many years of electoral history. It runs against the grain of the way Democrats have been thinking and taught to think for many, many years is that the best policy tends to be radical honesty, and that if you find yourself having trouble doing things like defending the Constitution or protecting American troops from being slaughtered in a war where they don't belong in somebody else's civil war, if you're having trouble voting for those for the things that you believe in and talking about them in a way that people find compelling, then you need to find a better way to talk, and that language is probably more the language of honesty and the language of emotion than it is political calculation. Because I think that the most devastating thing that Democrats are continuing to do right now is to cast votes for bills that they don't believe in because they're afraid that they're going to get branded as something or other. And if you spend your time worrying about what the other side's going to say about you instead of saying something about yourself through your actions, you're going to lose a lot of elections.
Yeah, let me make first a comment and then a question. And that was that when the vote came up on reauthorization and they sent Bush a bill he vetoed once, and then they sent it back and they caved. I wrote to my representatives and said, "You are behind the people of Iraq and the people of the United States on this." They already, you know, it. You will be applauded for courage if you stand up to him, rather than being afraid to be seen weak by not supporting the troops. That the people already know that. But let me skip to, in the 08 campaign, I got the feeling about halfway through that one of the distinct advantages that Bush had, this is in my gut, was that Bush seemed to be saying what he actually believed, and Kerry seemed to be figuring out what to say. And whatever you thought about their positions or their arguments, he seemed authentic, and Kerry, like Gore before him, did not. How does that perception fit what you're talking about?
It fits in exactly with what I'm saying, which is that what the data all show are that all voters are values voters. The biggest influence on people's voting behavior is their feelings towards the parties and their principles, which means that if you don't enunciate your principles, which Democrats have not done effectively in over 40 years, with the exception of the Clinton years, where Clinton talked explicitly about values, about opportunity for all, responsibility from all, and community. I mean, he was very explicit about that, whereas most Democrats have not been. And you know, on the major wedge issues, Democrats are consistently trying to be as quiet as they can, whether it's gays or guns or abortion, because they're afraid that the people aren't with them.
So when they have issues that touch emotions, they get nervous.
They get nervous, and when they get nervous, they run. And what people see is that they run, and they look like they are searching the polls for their principles. And the reality is that they are. And if voters reject a party that says, I'm not going to tell you what I really believe on this, or I'm going to hedge and get defensive, or let's not talk about abortion, I want to talk about Social Security, I think the voters are picking up something accurate. Which
and let me right. Pick up on that. Let me tell people, you're listening to Free Forum. I'm Terry McNally. I'm speaking with Drew Weston, author of The Political Brain, The Role of Emotion in Deciding the Fate of the Nation. And you can learn more at thepoliticalbrain.com. And there's also some videos up both at bravenewfilms.org and there's also your critique of some Democratic ads up at salon.com. So if people want to play at this in a multimedia sort of way, there are places to look. What I was going to ask was that you it speaks to what you just said. You actually say that deeds matter more than words, even though we've been talking about words, and that the way that a Democrat responds in a debate or the way they respond to these issues that makes a huge impression, and people are, from watching that, deciding how they'd respond in a confrontation with another country or in a crisis. Is that pretty fair to say?
Yes, it is. I think, frankly, the way you answer a question in much of America about abortion actually has more of an influence on what people will think about you on national security than how you answer it on national security. I mean, if you project cowardice to people, if you back down when the president says boo, it doesn't matter what words you use. People get the message that this is a person who is afraid of aggression and it doesn't know how to stand up to a bully. And do you want somebody who doesn't know how to stand up to a bully running your foreign policy? I don't think so.
You actually, one of the things you do in the book that's entertaining and I sense was fun to write was you sort of say the speeches I wish they'd said.
Right.
Can you give an example of that?
Well, sure. An example would be when George W. Bush presented his protection of marriage amendment to the Constitution in 2004. And essentially what John Kerry did was to issue a little press release that was quiet and that he hoped would be, he and his team hoped would be essentially buried in the news, that said, this isn't very nice. That was the extent of the response, and all it did was to embolden the enemy, to use the Republican language. It led the Republicans to figure out that they could then put anti-gay ballot initiatives on the ballot in 10 or 15 states, and those initiatives actually carried the election for them. So,
What would you have said?
Well, I would have had John Kerry come out swinging, and I don't mean to ignore the electoral reality that people have prejudices against gay people. And I also don't mean to ignore the reality that a lot of people have religious beliefs about, you know, what constitutes marriage. I mean, you know, we don't force Catholics to marry divorced people in their churches. And I don't know too many people who would force Southern Baptists to marry gay people in their churches. Democrats never say those things because they're too afraid to touch the issue. So I think what Kerry could have done very effectively was to answer George W. Bush in the very same idiom he was using, which was a religious one, by beginning by saying a religious and a patriotic one, by saying, Mr. Bush, that was one of the most un-American, hateful, blasphemous things I have ever seen a president of the United States do in my lifetime. I don't know what God you think you're worshiping, but the God that most decent Americans worship and the God that I worship is a God of love, not of hate. And he would never countenance building hatred into the sacred Constitution of the United States. And you owe every American, and not just gay Americans, every American, an apology for trying to wrap hatred in the language of sanctity.
Great. Okay. And for people who want to see more of those, they're in the book, The Political Brain by Drew Weston. Let me, before I lose you, we've got about five more minutes here. You now have set up shop as a political consultant, people listening to you, but you describe in the book some of the actual clinical research that backs up your theories. This is not just stuff that comes, you know, off the top of your head. Can you tell us about that at least that key study that people are referring to, so people get a sense of it?
Oh, sure. Yeah, the book is filled with research, and it's really about how would you run a campaign if you started with a 21st century understanding of how the mind and the brain actually work. And that's really why I decided to write the book, was because I was watching Democrats run campaigns over and over that seemed mired in a bad understanding of 18th century philosophical understandings of the mind, you know, which is the idea.
And why not use what we know?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's an irony that Republicans actually know the scientific research that bears on elections very, very well, and so that the party that governs with faith and intuition tends to campaign with science, and the Democrats, the party of science, tends to campaign with faith and intuition. The study that I think you're referring to is a brain imaging study we did in 2004, where we were interested in the way partisan Democrats and Republicans responded to threatening information about their candidate. And the quick version of it is that we presented them with threatening information, partisans with threatening information about Bush and Kerry, and watched what their brains did in action. And essentially gave them reasoning tasks where we first presented one slide they're reading that about their candidate. It sounds something good from him. And then the next slide comes up that's usually his own words contradicting himself or something else showing that it was really looked like a slimy thing to have done. And then we asked them to consider whether or not there's a contradiction. And what we found was that, that partisans did a wonderful job of standing by their man. They were able to twirl the cognitive kaleidoscope until it came up with emotionally gratifying results. And, they ended up believing what they wanted to believe. But the fascinating thing was to watch what happened in the brain as they did it. And the most important, probably two things I can say about that are, one is that the reasoning circuits did not turn on.
Say that again.
Yeah, that when they were supposed to be reasoning about, if slide one is true, can slide two also be true?
A reasoning question.
Simple reasoning task. If A, and B are they compatible or incompatible? They were always designed to be incompatible. So yeah. Can A and B both be true? The reasoning circuits that have been shown to be active in dozens of studies where you give people reasoning tasks, those were essentially the dead zone. What turned on instead were circuits involved in emotion, particularly distress, and emotion regulation attempts to turn off that distress. And when the partisan brain was remarkably adept at doing that. So, the major conclusion of it all is really the sort of central point of the book, that the political brain is an emotional brain. It is not a dispassionate calculating machine. And if you try appealing to people by listing all the picking the right issues that are at 60% in the polls and listing all the facts and figures behind them, and the other side is using emotion effectively and talking about their values, you are pretty consistently going to lose.
Okay, now we don't have time, and I'm going to give you about 30 seconds or so to answer this last question. We don't have time to go into your take on the current candidates, but if people go to that Salon.com article, you do that quite well, and you actually critique current commercials of many of the candidates. So people, if you're interested in that. But let me just say that you say that Democrats should go back and look at Jim Webb's response to the State of the Union. Let me finish with that. Why?
Because what he did was he was able to wed reason and emotion in just the ways that are most effective in elections. That is, just to give an example from that address, he made this statement. He said, when I was in college, the average CEO made 20 times what the average worker in his company made. Today, that's 400 times. What that means is that your CEO makes more in one day than you make in an entire year. Now, why is that effective? He's using numbers, and a lot of people have said,
right.
Weston's saying that we shouldn't rely on facts and figures. But what do those numbers do? They immediately elicit two things. One is a value, fairness, and the second is a feeling, which is, this is not right, and it gives you a sense of righteous indignation. Well, those kind of moral emotions are central to the electoral process, and they ought to be central to the electoral process.
Okay, and Jim Webb, as you know, is a former boxer and a former soldier, so he comes by this well. Again, the book is The Political Brain. The website is thepoliticalbrain.com. Thank you to G, my engineer, to Stan Mizrahi in production, and Matt Perez in traffic, and to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week. You can email me at temcnally@mac.com. New email address, temcnally@mac.com, with questions and comments, or if you want to get on a weekly list where I tell you who's going to be on and what we're going to talk about. For audios of this and previous shows, you can go to temcnally.livedigital.com. This interview will be archived for 90 days at kpfk.org. You check out audio archives and scroll down by date and time. You can visit me for all these issues at tmcnally.com, tmcnally.com. Stay tuned for the midday news, and let me remind you once again, if you want a voice in who oversees the management of this station and the vision that this station will take in the next year or so, vote in the upcoming election for the local station board. If you've contributed 25 or more since last September 1st, you're eligible. If you haven't, call 818-985-2711 more easily, go to kpfk.org, donate $25, become an eligible voter. There will be lots of avenues in which to learn about the election. You can email me during the course of the election for information. Vote, and as I always say, I believe we can do better, and this is one of the ways in which I believe we can. Thank you, Drew Weston. Keep up the good work. Hello, this is Terrence McNally. In the second half, you'll hear my 2009 conversation with Bernie Horn about his book, Framing the Future, How Progressive Values Can Win Elections and Influence People. Horn believes that persuadable voters make choices depending on how political issues and questions are framed. This is Terry McNally. Our guest, Bernie Horn, has worked as a campaign manager, political consultant, lawyer, lobbyist, communications director, and policy director with, among others, Handgun Control, Inc., Strategic Campaign Initiatives, Inc., and the Center for Policy Alternatives. He's currently a senior fellow at the Campaign for America's Future, and his latest book is Framing the Future, How Progressive Values Can Win Elections and Influence People. Welcome, Bernie Horn, to Free Forum.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. You've been involved in politics for 30 years, it says. How'd you get started?
Well, I have always been involved in politics. I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area, and it just seemed like the thing to do.
You went into the family business or not?
Well, my parents both were activists, but neither one of them were, in politics. But when I went to college, I joined the Young Democrats Club and met all my current best friends.
Wow, that's kind of neat. By the way, I don't know if you saw that the Young Democrats were banned at Liberty College.
Yeah, I saw that.
That was so funny because the things they espouse just do not conform to Liberty College standards. But, I mean, Young Democrats? Kind of wild. Okay, how did you find yourself? In other words, I read you've done a lot of work, on all the different pieces kind of politics. How did you end up focusing on something like framing?
Well, I have been involved in campaigning. I've been a campaign manager. I've been a consultant. I've done policy. I am a lawyer, so I have written laws. And it has seemed to me that during the early part of this decade, progressives were just devastated by the message framing that was done by conservatives. Conservatives have spent tens of millions of dollars to frame certain issues to try to make them more popular. They call the estate tax the death tax. You know why? Because when you take a poll and you call it a death tax, it picks up 15 or 20 points in favorability. When they talk about immigration, they say illegal alien, because that gives the picture in people's heads of something that, you know, should be punished and is not really human.
Right, right. I mean, it's too good. It's a great combination. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And even trial lawyer, they would rather conservatives say personal injury lawyer. And that's, again, because the picture in people's minds is an ambulance chaser.
Which one, trial or personal injury?
Personal injury, because trial lawyer can be a hero. There are plenty of television shows where the trial lawyer is the hero. So it's to use language to put a picture in the listener's head that tells the story that the conservative wants to tell. And that's something that we did rather poorly before Barack Obama.
Yeah. And this may be dicing it too closely for some people, but I asked you about framing, and it sounded like you were talking about words. And so I'm going to ask, and people who are interested in this stuff, you know, the work of Frank Luntz, George Lakoff, Drew Weston, yourself, all kind of are in this, working in the same arena. But is there a difference between let me say this. I do some work in communications myself. I talk about words, frames, channels of communication, and then sort of the linkage between all of them that should have a call to action. I asked about frames, you said words. Where does the frame come in?
Well, it is the picture that you're trying to place in people's minds. That is, you take a concept like welfare, and Ronald Reagan had a famous way of trying to make people think about welfare, and that was you know, the welfare queen.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you have this huge picture on the wall of welfare where all the various circumstances occur, and there's millions of people, and they're all in from different walks of life. And what Reagan does is it's like he takes a picture frame and holds it up to this very small part of the wall where there is someone who's cheating.
Ah.
Now,
okay.
There are people who are cheating.
Right.
But it's a tiny, tiny piece of the big picture. If he can draw attention to that part of the picture that supports his argument, then that's conservative framing. What we're trying to do is say, step back, look at the whole picture, and you'll see reality and you'll see something that supports our policies.
That's interesting, Bernie. I'm speaking to Bernie Horn about his book, Framing the Future. You said, in other words, you said the conservatives are served by framing only a certain part of the picture within the frame and then focusing your attention on that. And you're saying that the progressives do better if they widen out and show the whole picture or if they frame on different things?
Well, usually we're better off if we show most or all of the picture. But, yeah, there are times when our policy is more popular if we're focused in on some aspect that's particularly compelling. You know, if we're talking about illegal immigrants or unauthorized workers or whatever you want to call them, we do best when we're talking about children, when we're talking about people who work and pay taxes, when we're talking about people who are in the kind of need that is compelling, like people who are sick as opposed to people who are unemployed and are seeking services.
No, I hear you. I mean, I certainly both sides know that if you can do it for the children, that's a good frame for almost anything, it turns
out. Sure.
Yeah.
Like health insurance, for a long time, progressive policy was focused on insuring children. Why? Well, there's two reasons. One, policy-wise, they're the most inexpensive population to insure. But framing-wise, it's hard to not look like an ogre
right.
If you say, no, we're not going to give health care to children.
Okay. Where does narrative fit in? In other words, there's another, you know, in terms of this kind of analysis that's going on for the last few years, there's this other thing of, you know, there's a big narrative. There's a progressive narrative. There's a conservative narrative. And then, if you will, where do individual stories and anecdotes fit in?
Yes. Well, I talk about framing as three different things, that there is such a thing as framing an issue like the death tax, framing a campaign like the 1992 Clinton campaign was framed with the economy stupid,
mm-hmm.
and that it draws attention to, you know, that's the reason for voting for Clinton. And when it comes to an overall philosophy, what do progressives stand for, my book recommends that we stand for freedom, opportunity, and security for all. And there are pages and pages that explain why.
Mm-hmm. But so again, where do you see in persuading, in setting up one's arguments, in motivating voters, in changing people's minds, where narrative and anecdotes and stories fit in along with framing?
They all fit in, as well as who the speaker is.
Mm-hmm.
That is, you know, certain people can deliver a message more effectively than others. A police officer usually is a better person to give your progressive crime platform than an elected official.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's where I was talking about channels of information and so on. Yeah,
They are all important. There is plenty of evidence that people receive information better as an anecdote or a story. And again, it's part of the way that we remember. Humans don't really hold statistics in their heads very well, or doesn't really affect them that well. They have overall stories or pictures or narratives in their head, and once one of these is established, they tend to take any other information on the same subject and compare it to that narrative or that picture.
Or how does it fit, right? In other words,
yeah.
if I have a larger narrative, now you give me a fact, or you give me an incident, or you give me a policy recommendation. If I hold an established narrative or an established frame of that issue, I'm going to put it in there and see how it fits.
Right. And to a very large extent, if it doesn't fit, people will tend to reject it. You can give someone a fact, and if they are determined that that they believe something to the opposite, they will find a way to reject fact. And there are only a narrow slice of Americans who are persuadable.
I'll tell you, before we get into that, let me just see if you agree with me. One of the great examples when I talk about this stuff is, I think, the 2004 Republican campaign, which created such a narrative about John Kerry that you could mention the word Massachusetts, and I think a listener knew that that didn't just mean a state on the East Coast. It meant elite. It meant pointy-headed intellectual. It meant, you know what I'm saying? That once you lay out the thing, then everything sort of sticks to it like Velcro, and a really successful narrative, you now can get the same points for one little thing that you used to have to do a whole lot for.
Absolutely. And one of the problems that Kerry had was he didn't have a narrative.
That's right.
He did not have an overall message to his campaign. There wasn't an overall reason to vote for him. And the Bush campaign was, run much better as far as the message framing. And they really made it a question of strength versus weakness. Bush, for all the negative things that you can say about him, and I can see many, he did have one important thing in his favor, and that was he was strong. You know, he would strongly go in the wrong direction.
Right, and he would stick to it.
He would stick to it. And so Karl Rove said, that's our advantage. We are going to be about strength versus weakness, and nobody can say that Bush is not strong, because he will never back down, no matter how wrong he
is. Exactly.
So Kerry was painted as weak, flip-flopper,
mm-hmm.
This Massachusetts intellectual or elitist.
There was something else they were playing with, Bernie, which we'll leave the 2004 election in a moment. But they also played with that he was other. He was somehow other and different. He had that wife with the accent and everything, and Bush was us.
Yes, that is true. Although I think that was somewhat of a sideline to the weak versus strong.
I think you're right.
The amazing thing was that Kerry had this very important part of the strength narrative, and that is he was a war hero.
Exactly.
And so they had to knock that down, no matter how untruthful. They had to declare that he really wasn't a strong war hero.
Yeah, and I mean, it's you'll hear about football teams that will say we're going to run at their strength. We're going to attack their strength. And they Rove, I think, had a habit of doing that. He would go full force at it as quickly as he could. Let me tell people, I'm Terry McNally speaking with Bernie Horne. He's the author of Framing the Future: How Progressive Values Can Win Elections and Influence People. And you can learn more about Bernie's work at framingthefuture.org. What I want to do now is move into some of the I have said, and I know you agree, and I know that that's part of the work you're doing right now, that electing Obama is a good thing, but electing Clinton seemed like a good thing, and yet because it's my belief that because the progressives did not hold his feet to the fire, because he was not challenged from the progressive side nearly enough, he slid to become a triangulator. And that Obama needs us to hold his feet to the fire if we're going to make the most of this opportunity. Speak to that, please, and how that fits into the work you're doing right now.
That is essentially the theme of our upcoming conference, June 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, America's Future Now. We need an independent, passionate, driven citizens movement because there is no politician that can do everything that you want. They need to hear from the left in order to be moved to the left. If there is nobody who is pulling and insisting and, you know, wailing when bad things happen, you know, they assume that no one's complaining, that there is everything's okay. What we are trying to do is to help the progressives in America coordinate, communicate, use the same kind of language, work on the same kind of issues, figure out what they can do together to help Obama move to the left or stay to the left and not be pulled right.
And how do you answer the call that, my God, you know, he's arm guy. You know, we had 8 years at the other side. Don't attack him. You know, don't feed into this. You know, support him. What do you say to that?
Well, we're not attacking him. We're attacking conservative policies. And that's perfectly reasonable. You know, it's completely different to say that he has a bad motive or something personal to him versus saying, you know, we don't like the bailout of the banks, or we think that we've got to get out of Iraq faster, or we're not happy with the actual increase in the military budget that's in Obama's budget.
Mm-hmm.
If you take specific issues and you show, you know, why we're right, and you mobilize Americans behind the progressive position, it will move Obama to the left. And, you know, our real problem is not, it's not really Barack Obama. Our real problem is Congress.
Mm-hmm.
Obama would be further to the left if not for the fact that he knows that Congress will water things down and move things to the right. And the House is pretty good. The Senate is a problem.
Now, yeah, and basically, Obama was elected with a lot of big money, but a lot of small money. That may not be nearly so true for a lot of those senators. They have gotten used to winning on big money and serving big money when they get in.
That's absolutely true. Nobody was elected with the individual internet contributions that Obama received. And they all think that they have to go back to the same big business or special interest sources in order to get reelected. So it's quite an effort to persuade Democrats in Congress to, you know, take Democratic positions.
Exactly. I'm Terry McNally speaking with Bernie Horn. His book is Framing the Future. His website is framingthefuture.org. The conference is America's Future Now. Let's go to some issues, and let me set up a premise first. And this is my optimistic self, Bernie, I have the sense that the financial meltdown has given us an emperor's new clothes moment. And by that, I mean that people have realized something they thought made sense, Wall Street, big banks, etc., was to a great extent a house of cards. And actually, in this case, playing cards, a casino, right?
Yes.
Now, do you think, and this is my hope, that that creates the possibility that they will now be able to see through some other things? And in other words, the two things that come to mind for me most quickly are healthcare and the war on drugs. In other words, the war on drugs exists and perpetuates itself because no one examines it. They just take it sort of on faith. The mobilization against single payer, the fact that single payer is somehow not even on the table, is, again, almost on faith and not examined. Do we have an opportunity to get the people to examine these things and move on them because, in fact, they're not solidly against single payer or for the war on drugs? They're sort of passively, they haven't thought about it.
We can make progress on both. At the moment, the word single payer bring the wrong pictures to the minds of Americans and especially to members of Congress.
So that frame that's been set up, as we talked about at the top, is too strong.
Yes, it is.
It
makes people think of rationing, of a big government bureaucracy, and of being basically denied services.
Right. So the work that's been done over the years has worked. So what do we do in the face of that? Public option?
Yes. Public option is what's been set up. Now, what the progressives and Democrats are doing on the Hill right now is to say, let us have a national health care system where people can choose between private insurance and public insurance. And the most important decision is getting Congress to accept the public option so that everyone has the chance to enroll in a public health care system.
And to do so before they're 65.
Yes,
everyone does it when
everybody's in it once they're 65. Exactly. This scares the heck out of the insurance companies because they're afraid of the competition from an entity that's going to be efficient and, you know, not going to be after profit over health.
Well, I mean, just to give people, I think the overhead in Medicare is around 4%, and the overhead in private insurance is somewhere between around 25 to 30.
Yes.
And that 25 to 30% means it is not contributing to your health or your healing. And in Medicare, it's only 4% that's not contributing to your health or your healing.
That's right. And one of the reasons why their overhead is so high is that there's very little competition from one state to another, from one city to another. Most places, the health insurance market is dominated by one or two insurance companies. So they don't really have competition.
So while they have what appears as competition, there's a lot of big companies. In fact, they sort of have carved out their turfs.
Exactly.
They've learned from the gangs.
So if there is a public option that is competing in every single jurisdiction, then they have to bring down their costs or go out of business.
Uh-huh.
But the reason why we can't just put them out of business is, first, because of this framing problem, and second, because people who have health insurance tend to want to keep it.
Mm-hmm.
They're more afraid of losing what they have than they are of getting something better. And it'll take a long time before people say, you know, I'm up for moving from my current insurance to this public option because it's cheaper.
Right. And so what you're saying is the people who have insurance, whether through their employer, although that's probably the case in most cases, through their employer, have it, are solidly with it, are not worried about it, they're going to be hard to move. Once the public option exists, it does two things. One, it creates competition, so it should lower health care costs anyway, which is a good if that's all it did. And two, it will begin to say, okay, Medicare works, this public option works, now it becomes harder to demonize it.
That's right. Exactly.
Okay, let's talk about I'll throw it to you. If I said you got four more minutes, tell me some of the takes on what you said is that a majority of Americans agree with progressive policies. They don't know that, maybe, but they seem to feel comfortable with conservative philosophy. What you're saying with your thing of freedom, opportunity, security for all is develop a consistent set of principles, values, philosophy, and then show how all these different policies fit that. Throw out some examples.
That's right. For example, we tend to not say freedom from the progressive side, but, you know, freedom is the freedom from wiretapping. It's the freedom from unlawful arrest. You know, it's the freedom from torture. And freedom is actually the most powerful word in the political, toolbox. Progressives never use it, but we have many opportunities to use it.
Mm-hmm.
Opportunity is something that we tend to use and feel comfortable with. We have to understand that when we say opportunity or equal opportunity, we're really connecting with Americans. And Bill Clinton knew this. That was his favorite word.
Mm-hmm.
Security is something that, again, progressives tend to have been scared to talk about it because it sounded like, you know, we were agreeing with George Bush. But to us, security is not just security, you know, from crime or from terror, but also economic security.
Right.
Health security. We have to show these persuadable Americans, the swing voters, which are actually a minority in the United States, we have to show them that we stand for these overall values that they absolutely support. This is an idea that is very old. Dale Carnegie told us, 70 years ago in How to Win Friends and Influence People, that what you have to do is start from a point of agreement.
Yes.
Make people understand that you're on the same side, that your goal is the same as theirs. Like, we're both for freedom, here's how to get there. Show them that the progressive solution is simply a way of getting what they want. You want the American dream. You want that kind of society. Here's how we do it.
Yeah, in other words, one of the things you're saying, I think, and this gets down to if you were training people in how to go around talking about these things, is talk about what you agree first. Don't announce, I'm a progressive with a new policy. I'm someone who believes in freedom and opportunity.
Yes.
And then, now let's talk about healthcare. I'm someone who believes in security. Okay, we can talk about that for a while. Now let's talk about, you know, the Employee Free Choice Act.
Yes, exactly. If you want to persuade, you have to start by agreeing with the other side. I do train candidates,
yep.
And they say, well, you know, what about taxes? Because we're always on the wrong side of taxes. I say, no, you're not. The first thing you say is, our tax system is unfair.
There you go.
And they say, well, wait a minute, I can't say that. I'm for increasing taxes on this and that. And I said, no, there is no tax system that isn't unfair. They have exemptions and deductions and exclusions for special interest. They're always unfair, especially our current federal tax system. So start out with unfairness and then explain what you mean.
Yeah, and go from there.
That we've got to change the burden away from the working Americans and to the people who have been undertaxed and who've been enjoying all these tax breaks.
Yeah. Okay, I got to let you go. So again, Bernie's book is Framing the Future. His website is framingthefuture.org. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others at any time during the week by linking to the podcast. You can also sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. For podcasts, articles, transcripts, and to learn more about what we're doing, you can email me at T.E. McNally, one word, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y at Mac.com. T.E. McNally at Mac.com. And also that gets you on, if you ask, that'll get you on our weekly announcement list where I tell you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and some of the background. This is Free Forum. I'm Terry McNally. This program will be archived for the next 90 days at kpfk.org. You check audio archives and scroll down by date and time. Thank you to G, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi in production, Matt Perez in traffic, and to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again. I think we're moving in a wonderful direction, and we need to do exactly what we talked about on the show, which is not settle back and say things are taken care of because Obama's in the White House, but develop a strong, consistent, fierce, powerful, progressive movement to hold his feet to the fire. Thank you, Bernie Horn. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Okay. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to TerrenceMcNally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to get my weekly announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 10 or 15 links to articles that flesh out the conversation. As I say, good news, bad news, it's there. You can email me at T.E. McNally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, T.E. McNally at Mac.com. Or you can sign up at the website. You can also subscribe and listen to the podcast at most of those sites, at Apple Podcasts and Google Podcasts and so on. You'll find years of podcasts at those sites and at my site. Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, George Packer, and so on. You can follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to Keanu Williams in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. And finally, Rob Johnson, thank you and keep up your good work.
Thank you.